Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sankofa Radio, where we travel through the past before stopping here in the present on our journey into the future. I'm your host, Ascari Donso, and tonight we're going to pick up where we've been talking on Politics in Prison 2015, part three of our discussion. Before we start, I would like to do a dedication, which is customary on the show. And tonight I would like to give a dedication to Margaret Garner. Margaret Garner was a female who was formerly enslaved in Kentucky, and she escaped with her family and a party of other enslaved black people. And their party made up of about 17 people, and they escaped from Kentucky to Ohio, where slavery was abolished. And once the group reached Ohio, they split up. Margaret Garner and her family, they went to her uncle's house, a guy named Joe Kite, who was a former slave himself. And while at Joe Kite's house, slave catchers and U.S. Marshals found them and surrounded the house. And when they surrounded the house, Margaret's husband, Robert Garner, he began to engage in a shootout with them and hit a couple of law enforcement officers before they stormed the house. Once they stormed the house, Margaret Garner, he killed her daughter. And she attempted to kill her other children and herself before she was subdued. But her goal in doing so was to prevent them from being returned back to slavery, because that's how horrible slavery was. So I just want to give a shout-out and a dedication to the Queen Margaret Garner, who was willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for freedom. And so we move forward today in that spirit. Picking up where we left off last time, we ended our conversation talking a little bit about how the politicians, those in the General Assembly, utilize fear-monger to make people think that super maximum security prison were going to be needed in order to contain the threat of violence within the prison system as a result of the creation of truth and sentencing laws. If you want to pick up where I'm going with this, go back and listen to part two of this talk. And I ended by discussing that each one of those prisons costs roughly $100 million each to build. So that was four prisons at roughly $100 million. That's about $400 million spent. Now, there's about maybe 1,100 beds on each one of those prisons. So it comes out to about 4,400 beds at those prisons combined. Now, I was up there from 1999 to 2005, back and forth between Red Onion and Walnut Ridge. And while I was there, I had the privilege to witness at least 40% of those beds being contracted out to out-of-state prisoners. They had prisoners up there from the Virgin Islands. They had prisoners up there from Connecticut, D.C. At the same time, Sussex 2 State Prison, they were operating at full capacity with contracted prisoners. They had D.C. prisoners there from 99 until 2003. So my point is, they fearmonger used the stereotypes and the stigmatization of criminals and prisoners to create a fear that all of these beds were going to be needed to be able to contain this alleged violent threat, when in all actuality, the goal was to contract beds out for a higher price, because what they do is they'll sell beds to an out-of-state prisoner for twice as much as it costs to house an in-state prisoner. So where it costs maybe $24,000 annually to house somebody in the state of Virginia, to house somebody in Connecticut, they might get $50,000 from the state of Connecticut, so forth and so on. Now, it was these projections that allow for them to be able to go out and raise the money, get the money appropriated to them by the General Assembly, taxpayer funds, and that obviously had to be supported by the public. And so they sold this to the public, again, feeding on the stereotypes and stigmas. Now, in 2005, there was a master plan created by the Department of Corrections where they made a population forecast. They said by 2010, we're going to need 5,000 more beds. And they used this so-called master plan population forecast to build some more prisons. Now, keep this in mind. From 1995 until now, 13 new prisons have been built in Virginia. 13 new prisons have been built in Virginia. And all of these prisons have been built on projections. Now, I just explained to you that the first four prisons they built, the super maximum security prisons, they were built under the notion that they were going to be stopping a violent threat within the prison system, when in all actuality they didn't even put hardly Virginia prisoners on these prisons. So they were lying. Okay, so now, looking at the 2005 master plan population forecast that was given by DOC, the question has to be asked, what is the goal? Why is it that they continue to make these population forecasts when they didn't need beds? And the answer is simple. Virginia was beginning to build a prison industrial complex. A prison industrial complex. Meaning they was trying to turn the prison, prison industry into an industry of profit. So now, let's look at another prison that was built based on projections. In 2010, River North in Grayson County, they built that prison, and construction was final in 2010. That prison didn't open up until the end of 2012 because they didn't have the money to operate the prison because of their so-called projections that they were going to need to fill up the prison with the extra prisoners. Now, this is important because when we go back to the origin of this talk, politics in prison 2015 and beyond, we began talking about the stigmatization and how they use mythology to create a certain perception of crime, a certain perception of criminals, and a certain perception of prisoners. And we talked about how they use that to create public policy. And now we're showing how public policy has been used as a smokescreen, where behind the scenes there's a bigger objective. The bigger objective is to build a prison industrial complex. Okay, so now, how exactly does a prison industrial complex work? Well, let's think about right now. How many private companies operate within the prison system? You got Global Telelink, which is a private phone service. Virginia receives anywhere between $6 to $7 million in contract kickbacks from them annually. You have Kiki Corporation, who they sell commissary products. Virginia receives around $3 to $5 million annually from them in kickbacks. You have JPay, who is one of the newer companies, where Virginia is receiving almost $10 million in cutbacks and contracts. Meanwhile, they service out some of their services, like food service and medical, to private companies who are willing to bid to stay under budget. So it's a win-win for them. Now, these private companies have people who are involved in lobbying the politicians in this state to continue to be tough on crime. And this is where the connection comes in between politics and prison. And this is how the prison industrial complex works. Just like every other segment of our society, the prison, the institution of punishment, known as the prison, has also been sold out. A lot of people are looking at the prison growing because they feel like there's this rising crime and that there's this major threat to society in urban communities. And it's promoted every day on the news. If you pay attention to 6 o'clock news, every day they start off the news with some type of crime story. You know, that's like a common thing. And the idea is to project in your mind unconsciously that things are getting worse, when in fact, crime rates in this country have been going down since the early 90s. Violent crime rates have been going down since the early 90s. In fact, violent crime rates were going down prior to Bill Clinton creating the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act, which we talked about in part two of this discussion. So there was a plan that wasn't supported by the data. It shows that there was a hidden agenda behind all of this creation of public policy and all of this mass construction of prison buildings. Now, the question is, if crime rates are going down, violent crime rates, how is it that arrest rates are going up? How are more people being arrested when crime rates are going down? How is policing being, how is law enforcement and policing being more aggressive when crime rates are going down? The only explanation for that is that there's a need to put people in prison in a place where they can profit. So how does that work? Well, most people think that they profit by using prison labor, but in all actuality, that's not really the way that the prison industrial complex profits. They profit by servicing our products and services to prisoners who rely on money from their families. So they profit off you all. Through taxpayer dollars, right, they give us jobs and they funnel money into the coffers of the corporations like that, and they rely on us getting money from our families to spend it on products. And this is how they stay afloat. Meanwhile, they take their revenue, pay the state back, and also lobby politicians to keep the prisons open. This is how come they were able to make these bogus projections. Okay? So now you have to ask yourself, well, what is the role? What is the role of the prison in a global economy? Why are so many prisons needed? Why is America an incarceration nation? And the reason is because, like most people are talking about throughout this presidential election, and most people are coming into the knowledge of, there's a massive gap in income in this country. Okay, income inequality is leading to there being a very limited amount of resources amongst minority populations, places where there's strong, what they call high census tracts, where there's a whole lot of people concentrated in one area in poverty. And this is these are actually growing because the poverty rate is growing. More people are in poverty now than have been in the last 20 years. It's the largest population of poor people in this country than there has been since the 60s. And so that's an alarming statistic to think that America, where we tend to think of rich and wealth, has such a large prison population and such a large population of poor people. So how is it that politicians and the power structure plan on dealing with that? They build prisons. And so we have to begin to look at housing units and prisons as the new public housing. You take what could be considered one of the greatest threats to the national security of the United States, which is poor, uneducated individuals who have no place in your global economy, and you think if you leave them in the street without any future, without any hope, all they can do is pose a threat to your infrastructure. So you have to find a way to contain them. You have to find a way to put them in a position where you can still profit, too, because that is the ultimate goal of America, the capitalist, the most capitalist society of all capitalist nations in the modern world. So it's about containment. It's about capitalism. And so we got to keep in mind that with efficiency and what is known as the free market, automation, efficiency being the goal, and then by that being the goal, automation taking root, digitization taking root, and the outsourcing of jobs with all these free trade agreements, there's a limited amount of resources available for the masses. Meanwhile, there's a population growth within the United States. Each year, the population of the United States increases. So there's an imbalance. The prison is served the prison is here and to function and to serve as a means of bringing some sort of equilibrium to the imbalance. And so this is what it's about. Crime is inevitable when there's poverty. If poverty is going, if we are dealing with the largest population of poor people in decades, the outcome is going to be crime. You want to prevent crime, get people money, get people access to money, get people access to the economy, get people jobs. Now, the prison industrial complex also serves as a way to increase the economy, local economies, in poor regions of the state. And this is why you're seeing such a massive increase in prison construction in Southwest Virginia, which previously to the construction of prisons was the poorest region in Virginia. Hopefully I've been able to shed some light on what exactly the Virginia prison industrial complex is about. My man Stephen Biko once said that the greatest weapon in the mind, in the hands of the oppressor, is the minds of the oppressed. Begin to study, begin to look harder, look deeper, look behind the lines. Don't take what they say for granted. Challenge the power structure and fight back, man. We will win. I would like to say that's my time, and I would like to say to everybody, always keep in mind that the first step forward is going back to tradition. Without history, man, there is no present. Without the present, there is no future. Hotep and Uhuru.